Welcome to Peak Mind. I'm your host, Michael Trainer, and I am here with my new friend, Naveen. Naveen, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Great to be on the show, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It's a true honor. So for context, for those listening, you and I met, you actually gave a workshop that was around fundraising, as well as you have a particular expertise in exits. And it was a bunch of sort of high-powered entrepreneurs. And given your credentials and you know, the fact that you are, I would say, a young retiree and have a certain level of expertise in areas that people, I think, are very hungry to know more about, specifically, you know, how to raise money. And then once you are successful, when and how to exit gracefully. And I think at the core and underneath that, what I think struck me was your emphasis on mindset and the, if you will, the inner game. We are oftentimes focused on outer success and driven by achievement, but you had an orientation towards being that I found really captivating. So I just wanted to start off, can you share a little bit, just for the benefit of the audience, around your background and how you got to be an early retiree?
Well, thanks for that kind intro. I'll give you the very high level, and if anything's interesting, we can dive a little deeper. Like you, I'm from the Chicago area. I went to public schools, was fortunate to go to Princeton for my undergrad, jumped out of there, went to Wall Street to be an investment banking analyst. That was sort of the first 23 years in 10 seconds. I would say I was the typical son of immigrants from India, where you got to achieve, otherwise you're not going to survive, which is not a bad mindset for achievement. It's actually pretty good. It's not necessarily a sustainable mindset for contentment or happiness or fulfillment. So I went from Wall Street back to business school at Harvard, came out of there, went to work for a guy named Paul Allen, who was the co-founder of Microsoft, was a private equity partner with him for a number of years, and at some point had the fortunate financial flexibility to do whatever I liked. And that was about the age of 33, which I guess is a magic number in the spiritual realm, I'm told. Right, Michael?
Yes. So they say.
So, you know, during that time, I sat on the board of several companies, a couple over $1 billion. And over my career, I've sat on the boards of companies that have exited for a total of over $3 billion, almost three. So I've seen a lot of mistakes and I've seen a lot of success from a variety of founders, a variety of CEOs, had the good fortune to work with a lot of very smart people. And so I try to bring that real world experience to the folks I advise now. Done a lot of investments. I literally don't know how many investments I've done in companies. I mean, dozens for sure. Have raised over $250 million for the startups that I've been involved with when I was a professional investor, investing other people's money, invested over $700 million of equity. So I try to bring that sort of hard knocks, if you will, experience to folks today and share that with entrepreneurs like yourself. So it's a pleasure.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for giving a little bit of context. And I definitely want to get into the juice of, for lack of a better term, the inner game, a lot of the mindset training that I think you focus on. But people learning that you've helped, you know, 3 billion is obviously a large number. And I think there are a lot of people in the achievement orientation, which frankly, a good portion of my audience is, that would be very curious about, okay, how can I attract money? How do I raise money? How do I seek investment? Obviously, this is a large topic. We can go as deep as you want. But I think it would be really interesting to talk through some of the tenets and principles of how you look at an investment. And from the point of view of, if I were a founder and, you know, in a boardroom with you, what are some of the things that make you a hell yes? Like, what are the qualities either of the founder's presentation, way of being, that are big green lights? And what are the, if you will, red flags or red lights that you see frequently that keep you or others that may be behind the ability to Great. Make someone's dream a reality? Can you share a little bit about both the red and green lights?
Absolutely. And I would say that those are great questions, but there's actually a question before the question, which is that if you've actually gotten into the room with the investor, like me or someone else, you must have done a few things correct to get there. So let's first get them in the room, and then let's see what the red flags and green flags are, if that's cool.
I love it. I love it. How do you get in the room?
So first of all, I'll tell you some of the things that entrepreneurs say all the time. And that's what I know. That's just when they say it, it's a red flag. Not that I'm investing in startups anymore, but it would be a red flag, which is that this is probably number one, which is always that I just need to find the right investor. If I just find the right investor who understands me, who gets the business, I'm going to be set. That is, you know, that's a fool's game. That's like throwing the Hail Mary and trying to, you know, score the touchdown instead of, you know, doing the blocking and tackling and running the ball sometimes, passing the ball sometimes, and doing it, you know, one first down at a time, if we want to use a Super Bowl analogy, right? So you have to create the right investor. You're not going to magically find the right investor. How do you create the right investor? Well, you have to be out there building your network when you're not raising money. Because when you're raising money, the power dynamic shifts to the investors, and you're obviously pitching, and it will come across that way. So you have to build your network and build your credibility with folks when you're not asking them for anything. And everyone who's watching this podcast has had the experience of someone trying to curry favor with them. And that's never a good feeling. You're like, what does this person want from me? Well, investors are human beings too, right? They know that entrepreneurs always want something from them. So they're going to be a little hesitant when they're being sold something. In this case, your company. So you have to create that right investor by building a network of either investors or people that may know investors, going to places like the Kin in LA, going to meetups, doing all the things you got to do to build your network. We could spend a whole hour on network building, but there's probably better podcasts for that. But essentially, you don't want to always be pitching. Number two is I see entrepreneurs always sending their pitch deck out randomly, right? So if you're sending your pitch deck out to someone who's not expecting it, and for those who don't know, a pitch deck is just a PowerPoint presentation that talks about why you should invest in a person's company, would you send out something valuable randomly? No, you wouldn't do that. If you believe that your pitch deck represents your company and your company is amazing, you only want to send that out to people that really want to hear the story. But you know that we've seen people send their pitch decks out, you know, to 100 people saying, oh, well, if I send out to this many people, a few people are going to get back to me. No, it doesn't work that way at all. If you think about how many pitch decks investors get. If they're a professional investor, they get thousands, right?
Totally.
If they're a professional investor at even a moderately well-known fund that has a website, they're getting well into the thousands. And at a big fund, that investor may see, they're not going to open all of them, but they'll definitely get up to 10 pitch decks a year, which is just an insane number. So how do you stand out? The way to stand out is you don't want to be in that email inbox at all. You want to, that person needs to be having hopefully a warm intro to them from one of your friends or one of your contacts or someone you know that you didn't even know knew that person. But because you're building your network before you need investment dollars, people may be willing to more help you out to make those connections. So the time that I want to see someone's pitch deck in my inbox is when I'm expecting it. Okay. So what can you send to people that maybe it's a warm intro, maybe you met them at a conference, you don't really know them, but they're not a stranger either? Well, don't send them a 16-page, 10-point pitch deck. Do you really think that that's the best thing they have to do on a Friday morning is to read your PowerPoint presentation? No. Send them something, and again, we can talk about this for 30 minutes, but send them a one-pager. In the banking industry, it'd be called a teaser, right? Send them a one-pager that has the most exciting things about your business. It doesn't need to, and here I think people do, and I'm sorry to have a little chuckle here. It's not because of that. It's because you see it all the time. You just want to sort of smile and say, man, I've seen this mistake literally 5,000 times before, is that folks try to convince you either in their one-pager or in their pitch deck or in the first meeting to write the check.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think car buying has changed with Carvana and, you know, things like that lately. But in the old days, you didn't go buy a car in an hour, did you, Michael?
No.
You probably went to a few dealerships. You may not even know what brand of car you wanted to buy. You test drove them. You came back. You thought about them. You negotiated with them. and maybe didn't buy the car at all. Maybe you came back 3 months later when you felt more comfortable, right?
Totally.
It's the same thing with an investment. If I'm investing in a business, that's a partnership. Even if I'm investing a small amount, I'm not on the board, I know that CEO is going to be calling me every single time there's a problem, right? So I know that even if I'm making a small investment of, you know, $25,000 or $50,000, which would be a small angel check for most angel investors, even if you're making sort of your smallest size number, you know you're on the hook for helping that person, which is way more, the time is worth way more than the money.
That's also therefore, something probably people want to be thinking about when they're seeking investors, right? On the flip side of that, right, is not just thinking about it, which I think many people do as just, oh, I need, you know, X dollars, but more strategically, who are going to be the most valuable people to support me in my journey as a partner? Who would actually pick up the phone? Who would be deeply vested in ensuring my success by opening up there? I think that's a really valuable point that you mentioned in terms of that, you know, from an investor, from a, you know, investor's point of view, there's one optic, but then also from the, you know, the person who is, you know, who's seeking that investment, they should also be thinking very strategically about the people that they want, if they're fortunate enough to get that check, who they want to be in relationship with.
Absolutely. Thank you for double clicking on that. Yeah, choosing the right partners is very important because especially, and we'll speak to sort of the earlier stage startups, ones that are, you know, in the sort of before Series B level, the folks that are on your board, if you have a board, and the folks that are big investors for you will influence your company significantly, especially if they're active. And if you choose the wrong people, not that they're not well-meaning, but maybe they don't have the right background, maybe they have a big checkbook, but they're just excited about you and your business, but you know they don't really understand your customers very well, and they don't really understand your technology very well. Your best case scenario is they don't give you any advice. But as we know, folks that have made a bunch of money typically tend to think they know a lot, which is fine.
Yes.
And they tend to give advice. And if they're giving you, they don't need to give you the wrong advice, but even if it's off by a few degrees, startups are very sensitive, right? Maybe 1% of startups succeed to any extent that's notable. So if you're off by a few degrees on your business model or in some area or your key hires, for example, and you do that for 6 to 12 months, you know, the game's over.
Yeah.
Because typically you are raising money. In this market, I would say you'd want to raise money for 2 years before. People would raise money for sort of 12 to 18 months because they believed that they could raise money in the future. Obviously, when the market's harder, you want to have a longer runway because you're going to make mistakes and you don't want to run out of money. But any way you cut it, you're sort of looking at a 1 to 2 year cycle, a funding cycle. So if you're screwing around for 6, 12 months, I mean, that's not, you know, you're not going to be able to recover from that. That's why getting the right partners is very important.
It's so important. We saw it just with Sam Altman, right? Like literally you also can be ousted from your own company. I mean, he was pressured and brought back, but you know, is now theoretically raising $6-7 trillion for a whole chip network. But it's just to say like, not only are these your partners in terms of helping to steer the direction, but you are tied to them. And oftentimes as a founder, you can be removed by them if they are deeply vested in your company and things grow in certain ways. You know, I saw with Global Citizen how central the board was in our success and realized, wow, having alignment with your board members is so critical. And even one cantankerous or out of alignment person can cause you a tremendous amount of energetic headache and can be, you know, really, really challenging. So I think obviously when you're in the place, I think part of what you're just kind of double clicking on, part of what you're also thinking about is the mindset of who am I getting into relationship with? You know, I actually am writing a book about this topic of kind of networking 3.0 and moving beyond extractional networking, right? Like, and it goes to your very point, which is how do I lead with value and without an expectation of return? Because those are the kinds of relationships that you can then, you know, when you do decide to go off and raise money, those people are going to be the kind of people that want to help you because you've solely been a battery in their lives. But the challenge is, I use the word battery and black hole. If you bring in too many black holes into your sphere that are energetic takers and God forbid, one of your investors or board members becomes a black hole, that can basically comprehensively destroy potentially your future or the trajectory of the enterprise you're building. And so how do you think about, just to sort of stay on topic, but to sort of focus a little bit on this, how do you think about the types of people that you do want to get into relationship with? Are there particular qualities that you think about as it relates to the type of investors, the type of people that you want to be bringing into your enterprise?
Definitely. I think one aspect that's good for founders is someone who's thinking more long-term, which is pretty hard to find from typical institutional investors. But if you can, you want to find someone who's a little more long-term. That's why, you know, founders enjoy having sometimes family offices or high net worth folks involved, because they're not looking to raise the next fund, right? Mm. And they're usually more aligned with the belief system of the founder. The flip side is they probably are not going to be working quite as hard as the professional investor, not nearly quite as hard. So they're not going to have a network. When your CTO quits, they're not going to have a Rolodex of CTOs to help you with. So there's pluses and minuses for different types of investors. I think one thing before you even get to choosing that partner is for the founder, the CEO, to be able to see clearly, to have that perspective. And there's two ways to get that. One is the hard way. Most people don't want to make mistakes for 10 years to get that perspective and judgment. The other way is to really work on yourself and your own mindset every single day and spend some time detaching to old habits, old beliefs, old ways of thinking, and proactively imbuing yourself with the characteristics that you want to be, the kind of leader that you want to be. It sounds a little woo-woo, but anyone who's been around someone like, for example, Tony Robbins, who's been at it for 40 years, you know, Tony is an investor in one of my companies, so I had the pleasure of basically getting to sit way up front, where I should definitely not have been. We were sitting between Usher and Mark Benioff and some other people I didn't recognize, but apparently they were well known. This is not in any way name dropping, even though it sounds like it. It's to tell you that a lot of people make fun of guys like Tony Robbins, but when the best of the best are sitting there with their notebook and writing and with their families, I mean, I think in one event, Kanye and the whole Kardashians were there. Whatever you think about them, I know they could be wherever they want to be. I don't even watch that show. I only recognize Kanye. I didn't recognize any of the other ones, to be honest with you. I don't live in LA. Sorry, Michael. But I say that because you'd be surprised what some of the top people are doing for their mindset. They're not talking about it. They're not advertising it. They're not telling you what they're doing to get their edge. Mm-hmm. But the best CEOs, the best founders, hedge fund partners I know, they are working with coaches. They're meditating. They're doing the cold baths. It's kind of funny on Instagram now, everyone's doing a cold bath. But they are doing the things to work on themselves to get themselves clear during the day. I think Tony should be paying me for this ad, Michael, but he's been a good investor, so we'll give it to him for free. But he's been working with Paul Tudor Jones for like 25 years, mm-hmm. right? Who's been one of the best investors in the modern era for sure, ever. So if it's good enough for folks like that, I would say it's good enough for us. So bringing it back to your audience and the founders and CEOs that listen to your podcast, investing in yourself and your own mindset is going to be critical in the long term. Because another thing to remind you of, this is a marathon, not a sprint.
That's right.
It's very rare that you see companies sell in 3 years for a big number. It almost never happens. It's just sort of top of mind because it's all over the news disproportionately, right? If you're lucky enough to have an exit, that's coming, you know, 5, 7, 10 years down the line. How are you going to maintain that mental stamina mm-hmm. if you're not pouring back into yourself? Because the world, your company, your employees, your investors, your board, your partner, they're just going to take energy from you.
How are you filling your cup? I mean, I think, so you mentioned Tony Robbins, he talks about priming, right? And I know one of the things,
yes,
morning routine is something you're big on. I was actually talking with his son, Jarek, yesterday, who's a friend of mine, and he's given me some pretty profound insights. into kind of Tony's habits. I think what's amazing, I mean, Tony's now, I mean, last I checked, worth over $500 million and growing, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe well above that now. But one of the things that I was impressed by was his ability to be across so many different enterprises and to bring at his age. I mean, I think he just mentioned he's got a child that's in their 40s and he just has he's got a 2-year-old, you know, he's got children. Yes. He's got a multitude of companies. I've been at some of his, you know, seminars, and it's incredible the businesses that he's been able to hold space for. But also, I think most remarkably, the energy that he brings day in, day out. And what he talks about, obviously, is what he talks about priming and how he gets into that state shift and moving when he's not in a good way. So as you know, the quickest way to bring about that shift in state is through movement and these various practices. You know, he has a rebounder, he's a cold plunge, all of these things. As you think about, because as you mentioned, it is a long game. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And I do think the inner game, the psychological aspect and training of our mindset is probably the greatest key that one could have to being successful, right? Because it goes to who we're being, right? I think in our culture, we're oftentimes taught that it's our doing that is going to, you know, create this result, right? But at least in my mind, that's often backwards, right? We think if we do something, then we'll be happy. But it's actually who we're being that is the source of what we attract. And our doing, in a way, to me, is secondary. So as you think about mindset and being and how we actually train that level of being, which also, by the way, in my mind, is explicitly tied to the kind of funds you can attract, right? Or the kind of partner you can attract. Because, you know, I could be dressed in the same clothes, show up in the same room, talk to the same, whether it be investor or potential partner, whether it be romantically or business-wise. And if I'm hunched down, not feeling myself, not confident, right? It doesn't matter what I look like, what my credentials are. No one's going to be a yes in that environment. Whereas if I am authentically coming from a place of, you know, a feeling confident, of feeling like I have a vision, I'm committed to that vision, and my beingness emanates, then that yes is so much easier. How do you think about mindset and that inner game or that inner muscle that people can build such that they can walk into these rooms in a more powerful way?
Well, you bring up a lot of good points. I would say that it doesn't matter what stage of your career that you're at. If you're extremely successful, you're just starting out, you need to have some sort of mindset routine in the morning. Mm. And that's what I recommend for all the founders, all the CEOs, all the hedge fund managers that I coach now, is that they got to do something in the morning to get their mind right. And by the way, none of them want to do it. There's one CEO that's just an animal. It gets up at 4:30 and works out, but the rest of them, they don't want to do it. So the key is to come up with a very simple routine that you can then habit stack and build on over time. And so the routine I give them is very, very simple. I call it the 5-5-5 morning routine. 5 steps, 5 minutes, 5 days a week. So everyone's got 5 minutes. And I think it was Tony said, if you don't have 5 minutes, I think he said, if you don't have 20 minutes, you don't have a life. So if you don't have 5 minutes, you definitely don't have a life. So you should have at least 5 minutes for yourself at the beginning of the day. And so here's what you do. And I know, Michael, you're advanced in this, but this is a simple version. You put a glass of water next to your bed at night. Now, it's great to be hydrated in the morning, but the real reason you put the glass of water there is to remind yourself that you consciously put that water there because it represents that you're going to do your little morning routine and you're going to prioritize yourself before your email, your phone, your Instagram, your whatever, right? You're the most important person, because if you die, nothing's going to happen anyway. So let's be real. You're the most important person in your life first. So you drink the water, and now you're at the side of your bed, and all I want you to do is close your eyes for 3 minutes. I don't care if you think about something. I don't care if you not think about something. You know, people say focus on your breath. You can breathe. You can not breathe. It's usually recommended to breathe, generally speaking. So you breathe for 3 minutes. You close your eyes, and it can be 2 minutes. It can be 4 minutes, whatever feels like 3 minutes, and then you're done, right? Grab a journal, which is also by your bed, and simply write down not even one thing you're grateful for, and one intent or energy you want to bring to the day. So maybe you're a high-strung person. You say, I'm grateful for the sun. It's shining today. And I want to bring patience to my day because I know I'm high-strung. If you do that once, it probably will have close to zero effect. If you do that 5 days a week for a few weeks, it'll have a massive effect. Mm-hmm. Because you're basically what you're doing, like Tony's priming, is you're programming your subconscious to be the way that you want it to be. Because we all know that Google and Facebook and Instagram, they're programming you every single moment. And they're watching you and listening to you, or Alexa is listening to you all the time. And they literally have the most powerful algorithms in the world trying to program you, mostly to sell you stuff. So shouldn't we take at least 5 minutes to consciously program ourselves for what we want to be first, instead of letting the tech giants program us? I would say yes.
Yeah.
And the fifth step, because we have a glass of water, 3 minutes of silence, one thing you're grateful for, one intent for the day. This is where I'm going to lose everybody, which is just a quick, easy 30-second cold shower.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't say ice cold. It could be, for some of you people in LA, lukewarm is going to feel like cold. But whatever it is, the point is that when you turn that handle to the left or the right, whichever way goes cold, you're saying to yourself, I'm in charge of my brain.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give in to fear. I'm going to do one thing. And, you know, by the way, a lot of folks really like it after doing it for a while, right? It really wakes you up, really gets you fired up, and it's free and it's quick. So that whole routine I just told you takes 5 minutes.
And if you did that consistently, the muscle you would build is fierce. I think the other thing about cold shower is, look, you're training yourself to embrace discomfort, which I think is one of the most critical aspects for entrepreneurs, and also just for humans, is how do we embrace in our comfort oriented culture? How do we embrace discomfort? Because when you're making approaches, you know, you have to embrace rejection, right? Not every investor by any stretch of the imagination is going to say yes, and you need to get back out there and continue to make the ask. And I think cold showers, for me, I do cold plunges,
mm-hmm.
you know, are one of the best ways to train yourself for embracing discomfort and seeing the possibility that is on the other side of that discomfort, right? Like the cold plunge afterwards, you feel, you know, your brain chemistry, everything, your state shifts profoundly, and you feel amazing for hours after. And I feel like when you stack, like you said, habit stacking, when you stack, you move through those rejections, you move through the discomfort, and you get that first win, you get that first yes to your, you know, from an investor, that also leads to, you know, I think a greater orientation around being able to attract and give you fuel for more meetings. So I know I got us a little bit off track, but I think that was a really important aspect to cover over on, which is that morning routine and the inner state that we bring to the table. But just to sort of tie a bow on the an investor, what they're looking for in a perspective, mm-hmm. in a prospective investment, what are the qualities that you see in a founder when they show up in a, because we talked about a little bit about how you get into the room and the way in which you approach that, but what are the qualities that you're like, okay, this is a hell yes. Like, are there qualities that are either tangible or a feeling that you get from a robust, this is a hell yes investment? Like, what are the things, once, if you theoretically you've gotten a warm meeting, you've gotten a warm intro, the deck looks good. What are the things that look good about a great deck? What are the ways in which it's presented such that as a prospective investor, you're like, wow, I'm really impressed by this entrepreneur? What are the reasons that you would be impressed, and what are the things you look for in a great deck or presentation?
Sure. I'll give you three things. We could talk 12 things, but let me give you three things that folks can focus on when they're building that pitch. Number one, I would say, is metrics. So investors are driven by fear and greed. They are fearful about losing all their money, especially in earlier stage stuff. And earlier stage doesn't need to be super early stage. It could still be a company with a small amount of revenue that would still be considered early stage. Investors are always worried about losing all their money. But if they're not worried about their money, it's about, then greed takes over. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, well, I don't think I'm going to lose my money. Therefore, how big can this thing be? The way you get over investors' fears is metrics, data. Now, what does that include? Obviously, revenue, profit, could be one form of metrics, but it also could be customer engagement, right? All the numbers you have for your sales funnel or your marketing funnel. Any numbers you can show investors, any data you can show them, they can hang their hat on that. And they can't hang their hat on your market analysis or how great your team is or how great your brand is or, you know, how many podcasts you've been on, unless it's this one, of course. But other podcasts, you can't hang your hat on how many podcasts the founder's been on. It's really just data that investors can understand, because investors are typically better at looking at your numbers than even you are, right? Because they've seen the patterns way more times than any founder or CEO, because that's the nature of their business. So that I would say is number one, because after you're out of the room and the charisma of the founder is gone, or maybe the pitch was great, it's like, okay, what am I really buying here? What cash flow stream am I buying, or potential cash flow stream? How many customers do they have, and how engaged are they, and how much are those customers worth? You know, what's the lifetime value of their customer, and how much is the customer acquisition cost, right? Depending on every sector, of course, different metrics are going to be relevant, but talking about those metrics is important. And you may say, well, I don't have those metrics. Well, if you don't have those metrics and you're not aware you should be talking in those terms, investors are not going to tell you, by the way, you didn't mention the lifetime value of your customer. They're just going to say, oh, this person doesn't even know the language to speak, right? So you got to be educated on the language, and ideally you have some idea of what those metrics are or would be for your business. Another thing that founders often do is they fall in love with their product. They fall in love with their product because they say, well, I love my product, then other people should like them. And I actually hear that advice on, you know, podcasts or memes, like you got to love what you're selling. They kind of confuse you got to love what you're doing with you got to love what you're selling. It's great to love what you're doing. If you love what you're selling, it doesn't mean your customer is going to love it as well, because you're not the customer, right? You're one of the 0.1% of people that want to actually found a company. You're nothing like your target audience as much as you think you might be, right? So because founders often fall in love with their product, they don't orient their deck from their customer's perspective because they're not their customer.
Right.
So an investor really wants to understand what the customer value proposition. We know you're going to buy your product. You're the founder. We get it. We know you love it. That's not the point. That's one person or two people. We want proof that you have a solid customer value proposition, that you're delivering value to the customer, and the customer can identify that value. If the customer doesn't understand the value proposition, that's a separate but related point, right? So orienting your deck so that the investor can see your product from the customer's perspective, it's a subtle thing, but when you've seen 1,000 decks, you can tell if they're just in love with their product or they actually have talked to 1,000 customers, they've got a bunch of data, and they really understand why their customer may or is buying their product. And number three, because I don't want to overload you here, is the management track record, right? What about this group of founders or this management team, again, proves to me that they can achieve their business plan? Do they have similar companies in their backgrounds? Okay, maybe they don't. Do they have similar skill sets in their background? Have they worked at places that have done what they're trying to do well, right? Do they have complementary skill sets, or are they all engineers, or are they all non-technical founders that are great in marketing but can't actually build a product themselves? Okay, it's okay if you can't build a product yourself if it's a tech business, but that's going to be a lot more costly. Now we're going to add hundreds of thousands of dollars of cost because you don't have someone that gets in their garage for 20 hours a day that loves coding, that works with you as your partner, that's doing it for free, that's doing it for equity, right? So what are the different dynamics at play that lead me to believe that this collection of founders, and hopefully it's not a single founder, because I think there's some stat that, you know, single founder companies are quite rare, right? The Facebooks are quite rare because you need multiple people. It takes more than, you know, it takes a village, right? It takes more than one person to build great companies. So what about this group of founders or this management team tells me that they can actually pull off what they say they can?
Yeah. So ostensibly, if I were to distill it, you're basically saying an eye for the numbers and a real analysis of the numbers, an orientation towards an incredible management team, and like the track record, is the track record commensurate with what they're in the business of doing now? and then also an orientation towards the customer. So like, instead of it being like, oh, I think the product is great, like what is the traction with your product market fit and your orientation in terms of perspective around your customer loving that product? That all makes sense to me. I guess my question would be, is there a key difference between, so you assuming all things are equal and you have two investments and both of them answer those questions in a compelling way, but you're only making one investment, what is the X factor in your mind to determining the full fuck yes, I'm in on that, right? Is it the charisma, right? Like, it, you know, obviously, like if we look at WeWork or we look at other, you know, and that didn't turn out so well, but there is a certain degree to which, you know, charisma of the founder, at least historically, has been a determining factor. What in your mind is the X factor to make something that is on par to take it to that next level for someone listening, like in the room? You know, behind those decisions, what is there an X factor that you can kind of put your finger on that can take something from on par to hell yes?
So I'll give you two answers. If you're looking to get institutional venture capital, those folks are essentially trying to return their whole fund on every single investment. Mm-hmm. So on the balance, they're always going to choose the one that has the possibility of being really, really, really big, because ultimately, they really have no idea which ones are going to zero. So if there's an equal chance that all of them go to zero, then I might as well choose the ones that at least have a chance of being huge, right? If you're looking for institutional. Now,
totally.
If you're looking for more, if you're in sort of looking for people that are angel investors, family office, they're a little more conservative. So on the balance between two companies, they may actually choose the one that has lower risk. It doesn't mean it doesn't have still a great upside, but perhaps on the metrics or the management team, they just perceived one as being lower risk. Therefore, there's a lower chance of losing their money. They may choose that. So it really depends on the type of investor you're talking to. Now, I would say this. I would say you shouldn't really be changing your pitch or tweaking your figures based upon the type of investor. You may want to focus on different things. Like if someone's has a lot of experience in technology, spend more time on the tech because that excites them. If a certain investor is really good at, you know, B2C marketing strategies, maybe you spend more time on your funnel, right? So you spend more time on different parts of your pitch, depending on what the interest level is on the other side. But I wouldn't get into the habit of being a chameleon and trying to change your pitch too much, because all you're going to do is, number one, your pitch isn't going to be as good because you're not giving the same pitch every time. And number two, you may end up picking the wrong partner by mistake, which will be a disaster.
And how do you think about time? You mentioned earlier like a 2-year cycle in terms of when people are thinking about how much money they should raise and how long it will take to raise it. I'm guessing that for many, the period of time is oftentimes longer than one would expect. Mm-hmm. But in balancing, you know, as a founder must, actually building the business and doing, you know, getting those customers, getting that customer acquisition, getting raving fans of the brand, and balancing that with the need to continue to potentially raise capital to you know, get a longer runway. Is there a thought that you have around general principles to like how much time you should be spending on fundraising commensurate with your other duties, and or is there a season in which you're like, okay, for the next 3 months, that's my core focus, but you know, not longer than 3 months. Like, how does one create the right optics for achieving what they need to for the business whilst also getting the revenue they need to be successful?
So on the balance, I would say these days you want to be raising for a longer runway, mm-hmm. because the market's been very choppy. We don't know how long it's going to last in terms of when you'll be able to raise money again. So optimizing for about 24 months of runway, ideally, is probably a good thing. Now, of course, that means raising a little more money, a little more dilution. But when you are operating a startup, you are always facing the prospect of going to zero. So a little more dilution, yeah, you might make a little less money when you finally exit. But if you're reducing the risk of going to zero, it's a no-brainer. You want to do that all day long.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. As it relates to, because we've talked a lot about, I know, like, okay, coming in, how long we want to approach potentially raising money, the orientation around like what are the elements to make that fundraise successful. So let's say I'm a founder and I've now got the money I'm looking for, right? Like I've closed that round, I've closed that series. What are the things that sort of they're transitioning back into focusing on core business, but they want to set themselves up to win so that that next approach is more easeful and can, you know, generate profound results?
So you always want to work backwards from your next fundraise and think about what the next round of investors want to see. So you've just raised your $1 million or $10 million, and you know that for companies of your type, for the Series A or maybe the Series B, they need to be in this sort of range for these type of metrics. So make sure you use those funds to go try to build that case and hit those metrics. So you're back engineering the pitch deck you're going to pitch 2 years into the future.
Got it. And can you look at other, like whether it be competitors or go on PitchBook? Are there ways you can kind of like dissect other potential and kind of use that to help you engineer that reverse tracking?
You definitely can. And also, if you've got some investors that are reasonably networked, you can just go talk to the folks that would be in your next round, you know, years before you need their money.
Yeah.
Which is a great time to talk to them because you're just asking for advice. And if you're introduced through one of your investors, they're always going to say yes eventually. And you just ask them, hey, what kind of company would you want to see us be in 2 years? And they're going to tell you all the things they don't like and all the things they do like, and you're going to be surprised.
That's actually one of the greatest tips I ever heard about fundraising, which is when you're reaching out, actually doing what I call a listening tour, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of actually approaching someone with the optics of I'm looking to raise money from you, instead seeking their counsel. Hey, I'm building this company. I respect what you built in the past for XYZ reasons. If you have a moment, and ideally framing it in a way that it's of value to them, right? Like I've done my research. I know that you love, for example, the Rolling Stones. I got a couple Rolling Stones tickets. If you got a moment, I'd love to just, and I hate the word pick your brain personally. I think that it feels extractive and is antiquated, but I'd love to be able to take you to this show and just hear what your perspective is on, you know, this enterprise and basically enroll them into the story of what you're building. And my buddy of mine, Adam Braun, used to do this, and he called it a listening tour. And he would not approach people that with a hard ask of fundraising. But what he found is in asking people for their counsel and their expertise, they were apt to not only potentially, if they had the means, want to invest themselves as a result, but also they were more apt to invite other people into the conversation to make introductions, et cetera, because you were seeking their sort of sage counsel rather than coming in with the expectation of them cutting a check. And I'd love your thoughts around that as it relates to, and it goes a little bit to the principle of also like always be building these relationships before you actually need to be seeking funds.
Yeah, you have to approach every investor as someone who knows at least 100 people just like them. Mm. So with that in mind, do you want to go see if there's a 2% chance they're going to invest in your company, which is probably less than that chance if you don't know them that well? Or do you want to build a relationship over the long term where they could pick up, you know, their phone and text 5 people, and now you're exponentially increasing your network, right? And unfortunately, because most founders don't have any expertise in fundraising, and by the way, that's not a critique. Why should they? They may have done it once before, right? But because they don't understand the fundraising game, they go out and they're raising money when they need to raise money. But you're always building your network to raise money or find new hires or whatever, right? So you can't be, I always say, you got to prepare for your fundraise at least 6 to 12 months before.
And what do you do to prepare for that? Like, as you say, if you're preparing 6 to 12 months, what are the things one should be doing to prepare?
Figuring out who you want to raise money from. Mm-hmm. Re-engaging your network if you haven't done that in a little while. If you're running a business, thinking about what metrics you want to show, talking to people in the market, whether it could be, you know, small investment banks, advisors, other angel investors, and figuring out what's going on in the market, what the trends are, you know, and really being thoughtful about that going into it. It's kind of like when you were running Global Citizens, you wouldn't plan that event even probably not a year in advance, right? You wouldn't plan that 3 months in advance.
Oh, yeah. We were planning multi-years in advance.
Multi-years in advance. Exactly.
And one of the things that actually I learned that Global Citizen really drove home for me, and this leads also to a question, which is, you know, for me, one of the ways I want to ask you, like, how do you think about re-engaging your network, right? Because now we're all like, we have so many contacts, but we don't necessarily have so many connections, like true, meaningful connections. And maintaining those relationships, especially if they're not in the same town, can be challenging. And I'd love your thoughts around how you re-engage and maintain meaningful relationships. But one of the things I learned that I would share for those listening with Global Citizen is experiences, for example, like hosting a festival, are one of the best ways that I have found to build and maintain relationships. They're exponential. Right. So instead of saying, hey, I'm going to reach out to someone, want to grab a coffee or let's grab lunch, which I definitely do. And I can go way deeper on relationships. Say there's a group of like I just did this 3 weeks ago. I was like, you know, I'm just going to host a dinner. There's so many people. I'm back in LA. I just moved back. I was gone for 2 years. I'm just going to host a dinner for 50 people. It would take me so long to see each of those people one-on-one. Maybe some of them flake or something comes up and all that. I'm just going to host a dinner. I'm going to cover it. It's not going to be ticketed. I'm going to get a musician, you know, and I did that. I catered out. I actually got Indian food. I had a buddy of mine who was down to perform. I actually did it at the Kin. So I found a venue and then I just did like a dinner. And the things that have materialized as a result of that, even though that was not my expectation, have been profound. And it's because I gave without expectation of receiving anything. And it was also exponential, not just the value that I got for myself in nourishing those relationships, but each of the people there got to connect with other people that were a value for them. And that's why I say it's exponential, right? Because you're sort of the node of the network and you're creating opportunities for other people to create valuable relationships. And in my view, I think about relationships like seeds you put in a garden and you don't even know the ways in which they're going to cross-pollinate, right? The ways in which, you know, they're going to lead to generative possibilities beyond your imagination. So one of the greatest tools for those listening that I've found is think through experiences. Like I try to almost always have a dinner or an event or an experience that I can invite people to. I'm thinking about a month or two down the road, even if I haven't yet planned it, if I want to connect and get someone's contact, I'll say, hey, you know, I'm going to do this event. I'd love to meet with you. We met. I just knew, hey, I'd love to continue with this guy. What's a value that I could offer knowing that you're not in town, so I can't invite you to dinner. And I was like, I'd love to do a podcast with you. But it's just thinking through like, hey, what are the ways in which you can add value. But do you have any thoughts around ways in which, as you think about this, that you think about building or maintaining those relationships or networks?
Well, I think you pretty much nailed it with your example, Michael. Actually, what I've been doing lately, since I do a lot of mindset workshops for folks, those would be typically folks that are, you know, a little farther along in their career, who've sort of made it, maybe they've sold a company, maybe they're running a fund, or maybe they're the CEO of something. And it'll be a small group of people, maybe 8 to 15 people. And someone will host that for me. And I'll do my little song and dance and mindset. We'll do some meditation. And then we'll have dinner. But it's so different when you prep it with even 45 minutes of an hour of these kind of topics. People have completely different conversations, right? Yeah. People that would be uncomfortable talking about this because they're just not, their peer group doesn't support that, are happy to share because they have a lot to share. Mm-hmm. But they would never have had that opportunity if you don't sort of take the first step for them. So for example, I'm going to be in, you know, when I'm in Europe, I'm going to be in Italy and Spain, and I have two friends separately hosting me for, you know, a 20 or 25 person workshop, and then we're all going to go out to dinner together, for example. Are actually interesting because it wasn't my intention, but that's actually going to build my network very quickly in those cities. They happen to be good friends. So I'm like, sure, I'll do that for you guys. But if I really look at it objectively, that's also going to have the benefit for me. In places where I'm have a deep network, like New York, someone's hosting a dinner like that for me in New York City at their loft. So we'll do the same thing you just said. We'll have a chef do some mindset work, which everyone benefits from, and then we'll have dinner. And That's a very unusual experience for people. They don't get that very often, even in a place like New York City.
Yeah, I think what you just said there, they don't get that very often. That's another principle that I like to think through is what are the ways in which you can go where there's less noise, right? So for me, I think about that even in types of contact, right? Like, so emails are super noisy, right? Text, I would even argue, are super noisy. So I think about, can I send someone a handwritten note, right? Like very few people are competing for someone's actual physical mailbox that's an actual like value added card rather than a bill, right? Like, so how can I surprise someone? Or, you know, maybe I send a voice note or a thoughtful video that makes me think of someone. Or I know your friends, for example, you were just at Vailana's place. If I actually saw Vailana, or like I saw, you know, and we made a video and then we sent it to you, you know, how are the ways in which you can let someone know you're thinking about them in space that isn't crowded, I think is a beautiful thing. And then I think the experiences are, it's really, man, I realized when I set up an RSVP, cause I put it out for that dinner, I was like, man, I'm gonna have to host another one because people are really yearning for that connection, you know, for that opportunity to have those kinds of, like you said, mindful prompts. And I don't know if you know the Influencers Dinner, but John Levy hosts that. There's also
I've been a couple times a while ago, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Jason Gaynard, I think, does something called Mastermind Dinners, where he'll use that same strategy. He'll go into different cities and he'll treat people to dinner, and he'll have friends that are from that city ask people to come. So I think those are great strategies. You know, with the time we have left, I would actually like to focus a little bit, because I know one of the other aspects that you do and you've had deep personal experience with is, say you've created a successful venture and you're on that second mountain in life, right? You're financially successful, but you feel like your purpose, you don't know how you can be a contribution to the greatest degree, or you're in a period of existential quandary. How do you think about, and you obviously retired early. You know, I think many people are chasing the rabbit of money and think about, you know, I'll retire when I'm 65 and then get there and feel kind of vacuous sense of purpose. What have you learned from retiring early? And in coaching other CEOs, what are some of the things you think about as it relates to people climbing their second mountain in life?
The way I like to think about it is the achievement path versus the expansion path. Mm. And the reason why our wins, like maybe getting into college, maybe starting your first company, maybe selling your first company, maybe getting your first promotion, maybe winning a big, you know, sports event, whatever it is for you. The reason why those feel so good early in life, I believe, is because you had to expand significantly to create that achievement. So that trophy means a lot because of the meaning that went into it, because you had to personally expand and fight through your own internal demons and external demons to win. Mm-hmm. The thing is, later in life, the reason why people aren't happy with their fourth Ferrari, which you see in LA all the time, that's why there's some purple Ferraris, because I don't think anyone smart would buy their first fancy car and make it purple, but what do I know, is because there's no meaning to that third or fourth or fifth fancy car or that third big house. The meaning was when you had nothing and you built yourself into something. That's why we all love those stories. At least in America, we love those underdog stories, right? Going from zero to one, as Peter Thiel might say. But then as you grow, the amount of personal expansion it takes to make that next $1 million is basically zero potentially for a lot of folks, right? Mm-hmm. If they've done it 10 or 20 times before, there's no personal expansion. They may not even know they made $1 million because their financial advisor did it for them. They have no idea. Zero meaning. So what happened? What happened is very simple. The achievement path and the expansion path for that individual diverged. Mm. They were parallel before. So everything you did to achieve and do all the things that society tells us is great, like, you know, go to college, make money, be successful, whatever it is for you, all those achievements were aligned with your own personal expansion. Mm. But after a certain point, probably in your 30s and certainly by your 40s, if you're very successful, more achievements does not equal more expansion. Mm. Now you have to be conscious about expanding yourself internally. You want to use meditation, you want to use some physical vehicle, like whether it be cold plunges or whether it be hard workouts. People do, you know, David Goggins does ultra marathons. You know, there's all sorts of examples. There's different vehicles you can use, but you have to find a way, and it's not that hard to find a way. You just got to commit to it, to personally expand. And one thing I teach the CEOs that I coach, and they're all pretty high level guys. They, you know, most of them don't need to work anymore, et cetera. I teach them that you don't have to choose between the achievement path and the expansion path. You assume that, you know, I'm not going to be a yogi meditating in a mountain somewhere, so I'm not going to do anything. That's a very extreme viewpoint. It's going to take you about 17,000 lifetimes to be that yogi. So don't worry, you're never going to be enlightened. Don't worry about that. There's no danger in being enlightened. Please don't worry about that. I tell them, no, you just got to add some expansion path to your life. Mm-hmm. You can walk both paths. You don't have to choose between one. Keep your hedge fund, you know, manage the $1 billion or whatever you're managing, but also be conscious about how you plan your family vacations, but also choose to turn on a meditation track instead of just looking at your phone on the 20-minute Uber ride home. It doesn't have to be big things. It's not rocket science, right? But you have to be conscious about making these little tiny decisions each and every day to make yourself a little more happy or a little more content. And then, of course, over time, it's not a chore. They become habits, right? Like I did my Sadhguru Sadhana. I think you had Blue on the podcast, didn't you?
Blue's a dear friend, but we've done retreats together, but I have not had her on the podcast yet. Soon.
I thought you had for some reason. Anyway, I know that she knows Sadhguru's teaching very well. So probably a bunch of your podcast guests have done this, but I do his sadhana every day, which is a combination of breathing, some yoga stretches, and some meditation. And I am the last person, Michael, 4 years ago, that would be doing that. The last person. But after I saw him in person, I was like, wow, this is extremely compelling. I'm going to commit to 30 days. And it's been 4 years.
It's powerful. I mean, you mentioned Blue. So she just randomly did something called 40 Days of Devotion. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the process of it, actually. There was no charge to it. It's about basically what is the
Amazing.
More, the way I would describe it, the more, whatever that God, spirit, sense of more is for you, how mm-hmm. can you incorporate that into your life? And so as part of my morning routine now, in addition to my meditation, my morning sunlight, my journaling, et cetera, I now have a devotion, which has become incorporated actually because I randomly saw this challenge that Blue and my New York mind was like, ooh, a challenge. I like it. 40 days. Okay, I can do that. And it's what I'm noticing is the degree to which things are opening for me differently because something that was organic but wasn't necessarily a structured part of my day has now become part of my practice. And it's interesting. I was talking to this friend of mine who's this, you know, tall, blonde British woman. She was actually at this dinner I had hosted. I'd met her and we were at the Lake Shrine, which is actually not Sadhguru, mm-hmm. but, Yogananda's right. place.
Yes.
And she was actually telling me, so she had converted to Islam and wow. She was talking about how the prayer and praying five times a day, how that devotion to God had changed her life. She wasn't sharing it in a way that it was like, you know, she was trying to create anything in me. She was just sharing her own experience. But what I resonated with is like when we're committed to that moreness, my friend Mike Posner calls it a soul goal, right? Like what's a goal mm-hmm. on the other side of which I will be of realizing I will be a different person, right? Like for him, it was after his father died, walking across America, and then it was climbing Mount Everest, right? Those were both soul goals. And what I've been really thinking about lately is this process of devotion to something higher than myself, whether that be God, spirit, you know, something that is a service that is more than me, and aligning that to my achievement orientation, that soul goal orientation. And it was evoked as you were talking about that I feel like that's where this second mountain becomes so meaningful, because I think we can achieve the material in life, but when we align our day-to-day living to something that is more than us, you know, whether that be a mom or a dad being a good mom or dad, you know, focusing on the well-being of their child, or someone who's deeply spiritual, focusing in devotion to God. You know, the Super Bowl just happened here. And, you know, what I was struck by, I'm not a huge 49ers fan, but I was struck by, there's a beautiful Brock Purdy, the quarterback of the Niners, was like, you know, people get obsessed with money and fame, and I don't do any of that. None of that interests me. Like, I'm in this to play for, you know, his devotion is he's Christian, so to Jesus, and also to my teammates. Like, that's my devotion. And it struck me that oftentimes the secret sauce to high achievers is a sense of a commitment to something more than themselves. And I just feel like it's not often talked about enough, but it's really been something I've been stewing on lately. And what you just shared was a catalyst for me thinking about it and sharing it out loud.
I appreciate you sharing that and saying that. Yeah, I mean, a big reason why I do the exit coaching is because we're going through a difficult time right now, right? There's a lot of tumult in the world, and it's probably going to get a lot worse. So, you know, I've no desire or ambition to be a Tony Robbins or a Sadhguru or someone like that. It wouldn't even be possible. But if I can focus on helping some extremely well-resourced achievers who have massive networks and have their fingers on all sorts of buttons, if I can help them be a little bit more conscious in what they're doing, now I'm already seeing massive ripple effects. Yeah. Just by helping, you know, a few dozen, maybe it's probably more than a few dozen by now, but something in that range is being very focused on helping those kind of folks. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in Sweden, as we talked about before the call. And, you know, in the Viking tradition, if you were extremely worthy and you died in battle or you were a king, you would go to Valhalla. And people think that's Viking heaven, but it's not. In that tradition, unlike in the Christian, Western Christian tradition, where you go to heaven and you hang out and I guess St. Peter's there and you eat whatever you want and you have a good time. In the Viking tradition, those warriors are preparing for the final battle. So they're not going there. Yeah, they will be drinking wine and mead and doing whatever they do with the gods, but they're not there for that purpose. They're there to battle their brothers every day, kill each other. And of course, since they're dead, they're naturally resurrected every evening for the feast. But the concept is that if you're the worthiest person, you spend the afterlife preparing to help everyone else when the final battle comes, which I think is a very interesting concept. Wow. And very different than what we think about from a, you know, sort of a Christian tradition in the US. So when I think of myself doing that stuff with these CEOs, I'm like, hey, you guys are done. But it doesn't mean you should be buying 7 Hampton houses and buying cars and drinking too much $500 wine. You need to be preparing yourself for what's going to come in case it does, so you can help your friends, family, community be successful, because they're not, you know, they're not who you are. You're uniquely positioned to have a much greater impact. So as they say in Marvel, with great power comes great responsibility. And for those of us that are fortunate to be in that position, we should take that seriously.
So well said. It evokes for me, actually, the Bodhisattva paradigm, right? Where in the Buddha to be forsakes their own enlightenment, their own realization, to go back into the dukkha, the suffering of the world, into the village, and help alleviate the suffering of all other sentient beings. And, you know, I think that is where liberation truly lies, right? It's actually in that focusing out, that being of service, that commitment to the more, that actually brings about the fulfillment I think so many of us yearn for. Man, great conversation, Naveen. I really appreciate everything that you're doing and creating and that you're up to. For those that would like to go deeper into your work, how can people find you?
I think the easiest way is just Naveen Tukaram, NTHUKKARAM, on LinkedIn, or you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and put that in the show notes. Just a final couple questions here. What's a resource that you can share out, whether it be a book, a film that maybe you've seen lately that's been exciting that you would recommend to the audience that you think would be of great value?
I just bought 21 copies of 3 books for my house to give away to friends that come to the house. And I choose one of the books depending on what I think they would like the most. Would you like to know what those 3 are?
I would love it.
Number 1 is one I'm sure you've read, which is Untethered Soul.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Singer.
Now, if I had to give one book to a CEO that they must read and I could force them to read it, it would probably be Tony Robbins' Awaken the Giant Within, because that's so effective, but I didn't buy that one because it's pretty dense and a lot of people won't get through it. But Untethered Soul is a very easy read, but is perfect for high achievers. The other one is Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
Great book.
Which is definitely a new classic in the world of personal development immediately, right? Amazing book, amazing story. Can't say enough about him. And the third one is Neil Gaiman, Norse Mythology. Because I think we've forgotten a lot of the stories of our history.
Yeah.
And most people in the U.S. are descended from folks that were grown up on those Norse mythological stories. Mm-hmm. And they have no idea about them. I mean, they could see them in Marvel movies, but they don't really understand what the basis for all those stories were. And they're a lot more entertaining from what I can tell than the Bible.
Well,
a lot more scandalous.
It's pretty fascinating. Yes. So I'm literally drinking out of a cup that's fashioned off an Amanita muscaria mushroom that my friend Taro gave me. I don't know if you're familiar, speaking of CEOs, he's a CEO of Four Sigmatic, which in the category of mushrooms, they define kind of that category with the mushroom coffee, and Tim Ferriss and all these guys are sharing.
I eat their stuff every day, practically.
Yeah. So he actually wrote a book about the origins of Santa Claus, which is phenomenal. And it talks about actually the role of mushrooms in some of these Nordic, because he's actually from Finland, and in some of these traditional myths, which then also obviously, you know, because before Christianity, there were pre-existing ideologies. And what I realized when I lived in Sri Lanka is, you know, before Buddhism, there were animistic societies. And then also there was the marrying of Buddhist, you know, there was marrying of Buddhist princes with Hindu, you know, princesses to keep political relations. And then there was a coming of Christianity. With all these new worldviews, there's still a carrying over of a lot of the preceding ideologies. And they weave themselves into our collective stories. And I think it's fascinating, because I think as humans, we live out of great stories. Like, that's what I think drives us all. And it's very interesting to get back at the roots of some of these stories. So I think that's awesome that you're doing it. Do you have a great Norse story or myth or something you could recommend as someone who has Swedish heritage? Anything you'd recommend as it relates to either Sweden as a country or a particular myth?
Well, definitely check out Norse Mythology, Neil Gaiman. I don't want to take a ton of time telling one of the stories because he tells it a lot better. But it's interesting about the Santa Claus book that your friend wrote. I would love to get that book, because you think about, where are reindeer? They're not in the Middle East, last time I checked. They're in the north of Sweden, in Lapland. And reindeer, for those folks, they're like money. So you would never ask someone, I've made this mistake, you would never ask someone in the north how many reindeer they have. That'd be the exact same thing as asking you or me, how much money do you have in your bank account? You would never ask that, right? So the reindeer are in the north. That's why, you know, Santa Claus is pulled by reindeer. But Santa Claus is Odin. Mm. So on the winter solstice, the tradition is Odin would come and ride around the world with his horse Sleipnir, which actually has 8 legs. So that's maybe where the multiple reindeer come from on the chariot, right? And you'd leave a little bit of hay, and I guess now it's cookies, so it's now it's added sugar. It used to be a little healthier. Leave a little hay for Odin's horse, and he would leave you some presents. And we all know that Jesus' birthday got changed to match the winter solstice timing, right? That's not a big secret. So that's how, I'm sure that's in your friend's book, but that's essentially how the Christians stole that myth so they could add on to the pagan holiday and sort of take it over time.
Wild. I find that how these, I mean, this is a whole topic for a whole nother podcast, but I do find, having just returned from Latin America and thinking about so many of the places, for example, where churches exist, as I understand it, there were temples before that, right? So there's kind of these whether it be physical structures or whether it be stories, as religions and worldviews evolve, they're often built on top of or interweave with pre-existing stories. But anyway, a topic for another time, but I want to thank you, Naveen, for your time, your energy. I really appreciate the way that you just approach the world. And I think the insights you share as it relates to how we can build both meaningful relationships, but also how we orient ourselves mindset-wise to be successful, whether we're in the stage of life where we're building a new venture or we're at the stage of life where perhaps we're thinking about what's next after selling a venture. So, man, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it, Michael. See you in LA.
I look forward to it. Okay, great. Thanks, man. That was awesome.